If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome back, everybody, to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. All right, I'm very excited for today's guests. Joining us today is the incredibly talented Marcy Leeroff. She's a renowned casting director and intimacy coordinator. I bet you guys didn't know that there are people that are hired to handle all the sex scenes that you are watching, and they are called intimacy coordinators. We're going to get into what that is. But Marcy has had a career that spans over 4 decades. She has been instrumental in shaping some of the most iconic films and television shows, discovering new talent, and ensuring safe and respectful environments on set today. So we're going to get into her fascinating journey, the evolution of casting, the crucial role that intimacy coordination in modern filmmaking takes. But just so you know, several notable movies throughout her career, they're like the most well-known films, okay? She cast for E.T., Poltergeist. Do you remember that one? I love that one. Footloose, St. Elmo's Fire, Pretty in Pink, The Iron Giant, Mean Girls, Freaky Friday, The Spiderwick Chronicles, and so many more. She's so impressive. I was so excited when she agreed to do this interview because, you know, I wanted to ask her all sorts of questions that I don't think a lot of people get to ask famous casting directors. She actually gives a great story on how the role of Elliot was cast in E.T., so I can't wait for you to listen to that. Anyway, just to narrow down what an intimacy coordinator is, it's basically a professional who ensures that scenes involving physical intimacy or nudity are conducted safely, respectfully, and consensually on film, television, and other theater sets. I mean, in layman's terms, it basically means that they help coordinate and choreograph those sex scenes that we think are so real that has us talking like, oh yeah, those two totally screwed on camera, but they didn't. And that's because of her. So anyways, please enjoy my conversation with Marcy Leeroff. This episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Holistic Goddess. I have to share something that's really made a difference for me. It's Bison Trifecta from Holistic Goddess. I've been diving into holistic health more seriously, and Holistic Goddess has been a big part of that journey. For me, it all started with their Bison Trifecta, which is a blend of freeze-dried bison organs, heart, liver, kidney, in capsule form. Now, for some people, that may sound scary or even gross, but I'm telling you, it's amazing. The effects are tangible. You see them, you feel them, and I do not leave home without it now. When I first started taking it, I felt a noticeable boost in my energy and focus within just a few days. I was managing my hectic schedule so much better and skipping my usual midday crash. The energy and focus are just my favorite parts, but with Bison Trifecta, you get the benefits of 3 organs. Heart, liver, and kidney. It's comprehensive, supporting hormone balance, immune health, collagen production, and more. The purity of this product is just as impressive as the benefits. No vaccines, no antibiotics, no hormones or fillers. Just clean, bioavailable nutrition that your body absorbs right away. Now, a couple months in, I cannot imagine skipping a day. As I said, I just went away on a trip to the Bahamas. I took it with me. I took it every day. People kept asking what it was, and I was happy to share the wealth. It's become an essential part of my daily routine, and I cannot recommend it enough. So use the code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off site-wide. Visit holisticgoddess.com. That's HolisticGoddess.com. Use code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off. Marcy, I'm so excited that you're here. Thank you for joining us on Misunderstood.
Thanks for having me.
So intimacy coordination, I think that is a new role that not even people in the entertainment industry fully understand yet. So I wanted to get right into that with you. So I think for people, when they hear about it, they think it's just about ensuring comfort or care maybe for the actors involved in sex scenes. But first of all, like what kind of training do you need to go into be part of this job role?
Well, the training is different for everyone. We're still kind of in the wild, wild west period of time. The job started officially in 2017 and then sprung up many different training organizations. And some of them, quite frankly, were not really qualified to be teaching, and some of them actually were. Sometimes I work with directors that literally treat it like hot potato, and they're scared to talk about it, and they can't find the words to explain what they want. And some directors I work with have storyboards, and they know exactly how they want this shot. And so we go over the particular choreography. Some of them have in their mind what they want, some of them don't. And so I will help them choreograph the scene. And then specifically, what is this simulated sex scene? And we call it simulated sex for a reason. It's to make sure that the audience knows that this is simulated, because many of the audience members seem to think that they're actually doing it, which is not true. And this also helps the performers and their spouses or their partners in their head to know that this is a stunt, this is choreographed, this is all simulated, this is not actual sex. And so we talk about the simulated sex that they would like to see, along with what body parts might be exposed, because I would then go to the actor and have a private one-on-one conversation to run all this by them, see how they're feeling about the scene, see what ideas they may have, and then go back to the production to say that we're fine on some things, or we might need to work around on some issues. Then I go to the attorney and help them craft the nudity rider. And the rider is attached to their contract, and it explains exactly what they're going to be doing that day. And one of the great things about this new position is that we're working hand in hand with SAG-AFTRA to help them clarify and quantify what can be expected and what is allowed in auditioning for scenes like this, and also what happens on set. And one of the things that we helped them write was this new clause, which is this 48-hour clause, which means that production has to give the performer and their representatives, the writer, at least 48 hours before we shoot the scene. And then on the day, production can't add anything new to it, because what used to happen is some producer would show up on the set that day that no one's ever seen and said, no, I need you to do A, B, C, and D. And the actor was not prepared for that, didn't agree to that. And the clock is ticking and money is being spent.
Right. And probably felt uncomfortable about
pressured.
Saying no.
They're pressured. You know, there's a very inherent power dynamic that exists on sets. And it is very hard, if not impossible, for an actor to say no. Actors are hardwired to say yes to everything. And so this is a great protection for actors. And I also work alongside the wardrobe department, because I discuss with them what they'll be wearing within this scene. You know, let's say they have them in leggings, which is, you know, pretty difficult to get off in the midst of a scene like this. And then they provide the modesty garments, which are which cover their genitals, because due to FCC rules, we're not allowed to have genital to genital contact. That's illegal. So we always have to have the some sort of undergarment and some sort of barrier there to make sure that genitals are not touching.
Wow. Okay, wait, I have so many questions. So first of all, why was this role started in around 2017? Did it come up because of the Me Too movement and people needed to feel more secure? Or what was the actual reason?
It did start unofficially before. A lot of choreographers were asked to do this. A lot of costume and people in the wardrobe department were asked to do this, but they didn't have the background that we have. Mm. So in 2017, there's a show on HBO called The Deuce that stars Maggie Gyllenhaal. And they were going back for their second season. And one of the actresses in the show reached out for a meeting with HBO and said, "We're not going back unless you hire someone to be our ally on set," because the show's subject matter was about sex workers. So every week, every show, a new co-star, guest star would come in and they were left to their own devices. And there was really no discussion. You know, before this started, actors would show up on set in a robe and the director would say, "Okay, go for it." And there were no discussions about boundaries, consent, choreography, what exactly we're doing today, what story are we telling, and just leaving it up to the actors. And many people were really terribly taken advantage of. So that is part of this process.
Yeah. Has it been accepted everywhere?
Like, Let me go back. Yeah. So HBO signed on for this idea and they hired a woman named Alicia Rodas, who before had been working in the stunt world. And so she came on and basically crafted what this position is. And so she had movement background, stunt background, choreography, and they cobbled together what this job is. HBO loved it so much that they made it mandatory on all of their shows that have this content that they must have an IC on board. There are many other studios now that do require it, but they haven't made it official that they mandated it.
Why would someone give pushback though? Because I did read that there are some actors that have been vocal, like Michael Douglas, some others that said that they don't think that there should be an intimacy coordinator on set, whereas there are a lot of other people that have said, you know, they really need one, like Kate Winslet and some other people.
Exactly. And so you may notice that the majority of those that are speaking out against it are older. They come from an old guard of filmmaking, and they don't understand what it is that we bring to a set. I think a huge portion of my job when I get on set is actually educating the cast and crew what it is that I bring, because we are very misunderstood. You'll notice that there was press about Jen Aniston turning it down on the morning show. And the way she responded to it is that, you know, they asked me if I needed someone to see if I'm okay, and I don't need that. So that's like a gross misrepresentation, not casting any aspersions on her because she wasn't told exactly what we do. It's a really misrepresentation of what we do, because we're there just like any other department head to collaborate with the filmmakers. A lot of the, you know, let's say older people, like I think it was Michael Caine that said it was ridiculous, and you said Michael Douglas, they're coming from a position of power. Mm. And so, yeah, maybe they don't need it, but their partner in the scene that is just starting out doesn't have a voice. And so they need an ally on set. And that's why we're there. And so when this happened in 2017, yes, Harvey Weinstein was arrested and Me Too started up and Time's Up started up. And we grabbed onto those coattails really, really hard, because it really helped us have this entree into this world. And so now, yes, still a lot of people don't exactly understand what it is, and there is pushback. However, I get approached by student filmmakers, short films, everyone is aware in the filmmaking community about what we do and wants to use us to, you know, sometimes they're literally hiring us to check a box. And it's very obvious to me when right. I get on set about that. And sometimes they really need us. I've been hired several times just for a kiss.
Right. That was my next question. Where does it start? Is a kiss where the intimacy starts?
It, you know, when I read a script, I'll go through it and flag all the scenes when anyone is touching each other or when anybody is kind of hyper exposed in a situation to be vulnerable. It could be something like childbirth, you know, filming a scene of mm-hmm. childbirth where the actor is in a very vulnerable position. And so we get hired for situations like that. We'll get hired for minors that are kissing on screen that have maybe never kissed before. It's their first kiss or their right. first kiss on screen. You may remember a few years ago, the actress Millie Bobby Brown, who was in Stranger Things, mm-hmm. she was probably 14 and she had her first kiss ever on screen. And when she arrived at work that morning, the Duffer brothers, who were directing and creating, producing the show, were relentlessly teasing her about this. Now, it was all coming from a good-natured place, mm-hmm. but she was so uncomfortable and it was so awkward. And she still talks about this to this day, years later, about what that made her feel. Right. So we can help destigmatize it and make the actors feel so much more comfortable. Another show I just did, the actor wanted an IC there for what was simply a kiss. It says they kiss and they fall into bed. And we met and I talked to him for an hour about what this kiss means. And why are they kissing now? And why are they in the bedroom together? And why is she letting him back in her bedroom? And then I talked to the actress partner and we had another hour long conversation. It was just about a kiss and the meaning right. of, and then how we're going to actually choreograph that.
So I'm wondering, do you think a lot of pushback comes from the fact that older actors are like, but this is how chemistry is built. And when you're doing so much choreography and talking about it and prep before, it takes that chemistry and authenticity away. Like what?
Well, that's absolutely a conversation that we have. But again, these are stunts. This is all choreographed. And would you not choreograph a stunt? Someone's going to get hurt.
Right.
You know, you're not going to just throw a punch.
Yeah.
And so I have worked with people where one part of the couple really doesn't want to talk to me and the other part of the couple wants to account for every beat that's going to go on. Mm. And so I have to really finesse that to make sure that they're both comfortable and also know that they're actors and this chemistry that they're talking about is something that they're creating through their talent and through their acting talent. Right. And it has shown that improvising these scenes, somebody gets hurt. And Hollywood is finally understanding that getting hurt is not just about a physical thing, that it's about your mental health. Right. And that's really, really important. You know, another thing that I'm trained in is first aid, to respond in a first aid way. Like, let's say the actors are shooting the scene of sexual simulated sex of violence, because I did a show about sex trafficking. And there were some very heavy duty scenes there. And I'm there for the actor because they may get triggered by something incredibly innocent. And I'm there for the crew because imagine the crew is watching the scene over and over and over again in three different angles. Mm. And so they may suddenly have a panic attack on set. And so I'm there with some first aid and I can help talk them down, or they get home and it suddenly hits them. Yeah. And I encourage them to call me.
Right. I think people, you know, after the fact watching the movie, don't even realize how much goes into that one scene that comes out looking so true. Because again, in looking a lot of this up, there have been tons of articles about actors who have really had sex on camera. By the way, is that true? Have people had sex on camera?
In isolated situations, yes. But that's not the norm, and that's not illegal. You have to remember, this is a workplace. I mean, that is illegal. This is a workplace. Mm. You know, yes, we're creating art, but at the end of the day, this is a workplace. And now, again, since 27 and the Me Too movement, all the studios and all the productions
make us sit through a sexual harassment video.
Right, of course.
So yes, that used to happen in some isolated cases, but you know, generally, no, that's not what they're doing.
Right. Okay. It just looks like that in some circumstances.
Yeah, we're there to make it look like that and for you to believe that.
Right. So I want to talk about the logistics of that, because I feel like a lot of people are interested in that. How do you make it look so real? So as you said, there's a huge percentage of that into the prep. I just read something about, I think her name is Allison Williams from Girls. Is that her name? And she had to do all this prep. There's a scene in the beginning where, you know, her partner is basically leaning her over and motorboating her butt, basically, essentially. And she talks openly about what that was like and the anxiety that went into it and how they made sure she smelled like cake. And you know, she was very verbal about how she wanted to make it good for her acting partner and that she wasn't horrified, you know? And then I think as a viewer, you're just watching this and you're like, oh my God, how did they do that? You know? So I guess my question is, what kind of prep goes into it with you involved, right? Someone that's an IC that is physically prepping the area that we don't see in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of it is camera magic.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
In that you think you're seeing something that you're really not seeing. So it has to do with where the camera is. And so I have long talks with the director and the camera, the DP, about where, ideally, where would you like the camera? And I can also help you with where it would be best so that it really looks like this is happening, but it's not really happening.
Right.
So, and then it would, you know, her scene was done before ICs were on set. And so I really don't know exactly how that went down, but how I would prep something like that is, so there's always a barrier or some kind of padding. So it may look like the actor's face is right here on her bum, but it actually is probably at least this far away. Right. And the camera might, how can I show this? The camera might be behind the head of the person. And it just looks like that by the way their head is moving. Another thing that is really important in these scenes is breath work, sound, the actual sound, and the score. And so when I'm looking at a scene and I'm trying to dissect it, I turn the sound off so that I can really just look at what's happening. And then I can see exactly how it was really done. And so it may look like the actor is right up there, but they're not. There's a wide divide, and there's all sorts of boundaries and what is it called? I completely lost the word. Barriers.
Barriers, right.
In between.
So Michael Douglas did not have sex with Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction on the sink.
Not that I've heard of, no.
Okay. Because it looks like they did.
I know. And that's what filmmaking
is
all about.
That's the genius of it, I guess. Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the difference between an IC and then like a choreographer? Or are you a choreographer of the moves?
Well, I'm trained in movement and choreography, and most standard choreography comes in to dance. And so a choreographer on set would be choreographing dance moves.
Okay.
And so I am trained to actually choreograph the movement of the scene. And so, like I said, some directors need that, and some know exactly how they're going to shoot it, and they know exactly what they're going to do. But I work with some directors that just go, okay, you go rehearse with the actors and then show it to me. Right. And I come up with the whole gag.
And who's technically allowed to be in the room? Like, does the actress or actor have to have their manager in the room, or are you their liaison?
Oh, no.
And it's just the essential crew?
It's a closed set. And what a closed set ensures is that the actors are only dealing with essential personnel, like you said. There's unfortunately more personnel than you would imagine, but it's usually, and then there's also, you know, on a big budget project, there's monitors all over the set. And so all on a closed set, all those monitors are turned off. And only the essential crew can watch them. And they usually set up a tent so that people can't walk by and see the action. Mm-hmm. But it's the director, not all the producers, usually just one that will represent that group. The first AD, I like to have the heads of department of hair and makeup and costumes there so that they can watch to see their work to make sure that their makeup is still holding or there isn't hair in the way and make sure that there's continuity, which is really important. Mm-hmm. The script supervisor is able to watch. It's the least amount of people, you know, focus puller, sound sometimes, but it's as small as can be. Now on a small set, like a really indie movie, there might be three people on the set.
You mentioned before about how it's illegal to have sex, right? To have intercourse.
That would be porn.
Right. So that's what I was going to ask. What about, you know, there are circumstances, I think Robert Pattinson has talked about the fact that he jerked off or masturbated, whatever the technical word is, in a movie to get the real reaction. And there have been other actors that talked about doing things like that. How is it not considered porn in certain circumstances?
That might be the old days.
So after 2017, things changed.
Yeah, that would not happen now because, again, I work not just with the actors and the filmmakers. I'm also there for the crew. And the crew didn't sign up for that.
Totally true.
Yeah, right? So, like, I've been in some situations where an actor just wants to be naked in between takes. And we encourage them to, you know, put a covering on because the crew didn't sign up to see that. Again, this is a workplace.
Right. It is. Yeah. Let's go back to the chemistry and a little bit about like what I think you mentioned it before about people's home lives. Obviously, we watch these actors on screen and you think, oh, my God, the chemistry is their real chemistry. Like we saw in what was it called? The Love Story, the one with Brad Cooper, and everybody thought he was in love with Lady Gaga. Mm-hmm. Their chemistry was amazing. And everybody was convinced that they were both going to break up at their home lives and be together. It didn't happen. At least we didn't see that happen. What I guess my question is, I'm sure it happens enough that people do fall in love with their characters, but like, is it more technical behind the scenes than we really know? And we're just seeing really good acting. Like, what would you say being on the inside of that?
I think it's a little of both. You know, I've been a longtime casting director, and so I put together ensembles and couples all the time. And we do have what we call a chemistry read, where we put them together and they read a scene or they just hang out and we watch them and we can see what kind of chemistry there might be. For instance, I worked on the first Raiders and the second movie, Indiana Jones. Mm-hmm. And when we're casting for the two leads, we would have the actors come to the producer's office and we had this fabulous kitchen. And so we put them together to make a meal or to make a dish and to see and filmed it and just to see how they interacted. And so chemistry is something that you can't really manufacture. It's either there or it's not. But then being a really good actor helps sell that.
Right. Wait, on a sidebar, have you ever seen it that two people in real life really don't get along, but their chemistry on camera is exquisite?
Yeah. And many times that dislike, that fire, you know, hate is the opposite of love.
Yeah. So that friction.
And so either both of them have passion. And so they both just like feed into that passion and use that.
Yeah. So it can translate.
Well. Yeah, it absolutely does.
But do you ever have people coming on the set from like home trying to watch what's going on and you need to get them off?
They're not allowed. No, they're absolutely not allowed because it'll make the actor self-conscious and it will make all the other people in the scene incredibly uncomfortable and it'll be really awkward and they're not essential. There's no reason why they should be there.
Right. Okay. So do you think this is going to be a mainstream? You said HBO started with all of their shows and other people followed. Will it be something that you have to have going forward?
Soon, yes. So in the latest SAG contract, which is 2023, they put in a clause that said that if there's simulated sex or nudity, it's best practices to have, they say best practices at this point, to have an IC on set or if the actor asks for one and they will not be retaliated against. Mm. So right now, SAG-AFTRA is going to be negotiating with the AMPTP to bring us into the union, which is very, very exciting. And at that point, or sometime soon, I imagine they will make it mandatory. They've been trying to do that, but at the time that these contracts were negotiated, there weren't really enough of us to go around to make it mandatory. Now there's absolutely enough of us. The marketplace is saturated with intimacy coordinators. During COVID, a lot of people trained and became ICs. A lot of people waved a wand over their head and said that they're an IC, and they're really not quite trained enough, but there's a glut. There's a lot of us, like LA, all the marketplaces like LA, Atlanta, New York, and we're global now. Like there are ICs in almost every country.
Could people have this as their full-time job and nothing else? Or is this like a side job?
There are those that are definitely making a living. I'm working myself up to that because there are so many of us. And like I said, there's a lot of people that have just claimed that they're ICs, and they're undercutting us and underbidding us. And so a lot of line producers who hire us don't know what they're bringing in, and they're really happy to hire somebody for less than half of what I would get. And it usually backfires on them. But soon, yes, I think people could make a living at this. Yes.
And what would
also, you know, the business is in a really shitty position right now. We're coming off of years of COVID, the strike. The business is upside down right now. It's really, really slow.
Yeah.
And so, we're in a, you know, historically in a very strange time in terms of production.
Yeah. But it seems like an essential job that's going to be needed on those shoots. I would think that that's going to become an essential part of making a movie or.
Absolutely. And once SAG declares it as mandatory, it'll certainly help. But like I said, Amazon, Apple, they all use us. It doesn't say they're mandatory, but they all use us for any scene that has to do with this.
And could an actor be hired to be on a film or show and say, I want, and that's part of my contract?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah,
so it doesn't have to be part of the film originally. They can request.
Yeah, absolutely. And like it says in the SAG contract that they can ask for one and there will be no retaliation.
Right. Okay. What for somebody that might be listening that want to get into this kind of field, what do you say would make the best qualities for someone that's an IC?
Well, one thing that is essential that many people don't realize is that you have to have set experience. That's not something that can really be taught. You absolutely have to have lived on a set mm-hmm. and understand the set etiquette and just how things work, because it is like a foreign language. It's like it's a foreign city when you come in there. And so I get asked by many sex educators or sex psychologists, how can I do this? And yet they have no understanding of filmmaking. Mm. And so that is absolutely essential. Most people don't even realize, because I understand, you know, I come from a casting background. And so I know how to talk to act. I come in with like a different toolkit than a lot of ICs, because I know how to talk to actors. I have been coaching for the last 13, 14 years. So I come in knowing exactly how to help them get from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. I've been working with directors for the last 45 years. I understand where the camera needs to go. You know, it's very important to know like what setups are and what these camera terms mean, and how stuff is shot to make these scenes work. So if you don't have that experience, then the training doesn't really give you that.
And there's probably something to be said for someone who really is your advocate, that when inside you might be thinking, oh my God, this doesn't feel comfortable, that you know that person is also seeing that and feeling that and will stop what's going on and have a conversation. I would think yes. that's essential.
I have my empathy level is huge. It's kind of part. I say it's kind of baked into my DNA, quite honestly. Like since I've been a casting director, I'm always there to protect the actor because they're in such a vulnerable position mm-hmm. and to help the director navigate this system. And it's just always been really in my blood to speak up for those that don't have a voice.
Yeah.
That's right. Just the way I was born. And so when I heard about this job in 2017, I knew it had elements that I would really excel in.
Right. So, all right. Are there any films that or shows that you've done that were your favorites, that when I say favorites, it could be for any reason, that you took two people and had to literally explain how to find intimacy, or the coordination was great, or when it came out, you were like, oh my God, I'm so proud of this.
Well, that's kind of like choosing my favorite baby, which would be really hard to do. But I did have a really amazing experience on this show called Hightown that I did for 2 seasons. So they had their first season without an IC because they didn't exist then. And then I did season 2 and season 3. And it's on Stars. It's an amazing show if you haven't seen it. And there was a lot of content, a lot of simulated sex, a lot of nudity. The main set was a strip club. And so I was always dealing with about 3 or 4 principal actors and then maybe 15 background players of strippers. And so I also look out for all the background players as well. So I had a lot on my plate, and it really exercised all of my training. And I would go home from work and go, man, like, that was a really good day. And I feel really needed, and that I made a difference. And that makes me feel it's a really amazing feeling. One of the scenes that we did in this show on the 3rd season is a 60 person orgy, which I did single-handedly. And I still have PTSD from it.
I'm sure.
But, you know, that just tests all of my skills. It was a lot.
Wow. Okay. That does sound like a lot. I don't even know how to coordinate that. I'm curious if anyone uses you to come up to you and talk to, if they feel like they're slipping out of their character and they are falling for their counterpart.
That hasn't happened.
But do you think that's like something that could, where you could step in?
Yeah, I mean, sorry to cut you off, but it all depends on the relationship that we have and how much they lean on me and trust me. You know, I have worked with some actors that are like, I'm cool. And I know to like really pull back. And I work with other actors that are really struggling and they've never done scenes like this ever. I've done a few things with actors that have never exposed themselves, have never had any simulated sex scenes. And, you know, I need to teach them how to have an orgasm on screen.
Right.
Terrifying. And comfortable with that.
Yeah.
Because it's so vulnerable and it's so exposed, and it's a real personal thing, and they know they've signed up for it, but they're scared. And so what's great about this job is that we do so much preparation so that by the time we get on set, there's no surprises. And they feel so comfortable that they even give more because they know that no one's going to take advantage of them. They don't have to grow eyes in the back of their head. They know that I'm there with eyes on them to make sure that everything goes well and that nothing goes sideways, so that they're so comfortable they can just dig into their work, which is a really great feeling for an actor to just to relax and really immerse themselves in the character, because they know that all these other elements have already been talked about and they're settled.
Right. So how did you personally fall into getting into this line of work? Because I know that you have a huge career in casting before this. What made you want to do this?
Well, I've been casting for a long time, several decades, and I feel like I've worked with some of the best directors out there and cast some really interesting movies. And I've been looking for my next act for some time, and I wasn't able to find it. And then I heard about this and thought, this just is such a great mesh of all of my skills of working with actors and filmmakers, which I love. And then having some sort of, you know, being on this new wave of change, which is so exciting to me to know that actors will never have to go through what they had gone through for decades in filmmaking. You know, you look at, I think this was last year, it might've been the year before, but the actors who were in Franco Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, they were 15 and 16 years old. They were talked into or forced a nude scene that they didn't really didn't sign up for, but this was shot in Italy. You know, things were very different then. And they did this nude scene. Now that things have changed so much, they sued Paramount, the filmmakers and the whole production. This was 40 years ago, and they're still dealing with this psychological scar.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's exciting now to be involved in something knowing that that sort of thing will never happen again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that you said that Steven Spielberg kind of gave you your first leg up in the industry of casting. Can you tell that story?
Well, I was working for an office called Fenton and Feinberg. It was Mike Fenton and Jane Feinberg. And casting was very different then in that there were only probably 8 to 10 offices, if that, across the country that were major casting directors. Now there's probably 300 of us, you know. I was with Fenton and Feinberg for 5 years, and they really brought me up. You know, they really taught me a lot. And I was casting along with Mike Fenton, E.T. And he was really he was so great. We did many films for him, but that was the first film that I actually got billing on, that I got my name on the screen. And that changed everything. And so he was part of that. Kathy Kennedy, the producer, along with Frank Marshall, were also a huge part of making that happen. And so once that happened, the next thing was the producers on Footloose ran into Steven right after E.T. came out, and said, you know, who found these kids? And he said, me. And so that really helped put me on the map. And then I got Footloose, and then I went off on my own and things took off.
So, you know, it's so interesting because as I was a little girl, the shows that you cast were all my favorites, like E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, Poltergeist, Footloose, of course. I know every line to every one of these movies, which I think is fantastic. But when I was pregnant with my first daughter, I wanted to give her a name that I loved, and I ended up naming her Wyatt. A boy's name, but the name I was going to name her was Elliot because of the character in E.T. And E.T. was one, when she was little, it was one of the first movies when I kind of knew she could like pay attention. I was like, you have to see this movie. It's so good. You'll love it. And, you know, I think from somebody who's clearly not in the industry, doesn't know anything about it, casting is what makes a movie, I would assume. It either makes it or breaks it, because I'm sure the script was fantastic to begin with. And then you have these directors and whoever, producers, that are unbelievable. But that kid, the two kids, and, you know, Drew Barrymore, it made their career and it made the movie so fantastic. So how do you know, like, how you're going to pick that right character, especially if they're not famous already? How do you know they're going to be right for the role and that they're going to bring that role out and make the movie what it becomes?
It's really a sixth sense. It's something in my gut. I grew up watching so much television and watched so many movies, and I just had this innate affinity for it. And then, like I said, working at Fenton Feinberg for 5 years, I was exposed to so many actors. And again, you have to do your homework. You know, you have to watch a lot of films and watch a lot of old films and understand what a character brings. And when we cast the Elliot part, we had all decided on another kid. And we wanted to see what his chemistry was like with all the other kids that we had chosen, because we had chosen kids for the best friend and the brother. And so we brought them all together at the writer's house and had them play Dungeons and Dragons together, and and stood on the outside of the room and just kind of watched them play. And in a few minutes, it became really obvious that nobody liked this little boy.
Oh.
And it was not going well. And I was sitting there going, oh shit, like I have to start over. And it became very clear that he was not our boy. And so just then, a director director and production designer named Jack Fisk just directed a movie with his wife, Sissy Spacek, in Texas. And they found this little boy from a farm in the middle of nowhere in Texas, their casting person did. And so he told Spielberg about this boy, and that was Henry Thomas. And we flew him and his mother into Los Angeles to do a screen test. And again, this is before videotape existed. You know, we use like big old cameras. Mm-hmm. And so he read for us, and he was exhausted and weary, and it just didn't go great, but we saw something in him. You know, he looked the part for sure. And so Steven suggested an improv. And so he did an improvisation scene with my boss, Mike Fenton, where Fenton was playing the a representative of NASA. Mm-hmm. And he was there because he had heard that there was an alien living in his house, and they wanted him so that they could study him. And Henry, your job is to do everything you can do to not let him take him. Go. And there's a video on YouTube that you can watch. Have you seen this?
No.
Oh, gosh. You have to show it to your little girl.
I will. Will it bring me to tears?
And in like 2 seconds, he had us all weeping. We were all behind the camera weeping. He just used his nervous energy into doing anything he could do to keep that alien, because he was his friend. I mean, kids are amazing because they understand imagination. Yes. You know, their imagination is enormous. They also don't have an ego formed yet. And so they will do anything. They don't care whether they look stupid.
Right.
And so, right. And as we get older and we, you know, get into puberty, we start building those blocks to make ourselves look cool.
Right.
And your imagination goes like this, and you're more aloof in a way.
Right. And isn't it interesting that these little kids that have very little training or none at all are just so good, and the part becomes them, they become the part, whereas there are people that can study acting their whole lives just to be an actor.
Well, I always, true. I teach acting as well and coach actors, and I always encourage these adult actors to get back to where they were as kids.
Mm.
Because when you're a kid, you were just so open and full of imagination and trust before the world squashed you. So
right. That's very true. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know that you teach people about auditioning, or you tell people how to audition better. Is there one or two things you would stress for that stressful situation that I know even the best actors, some of them hate auditioning?
I think it's like I said, is that you've got to get back to where you were as a kid, where your imagination was flowing. Mm-hmm. And you've got to get rid of the notion that you're there for a test, or mm-hmm. that it's a hurdle that you have to get over. You should come into audition going, feeling like a collaborator, which I think is really important. You feel like you're one of the filmmakers, because you are. You're a piece of this puzzle that we need. And come in to play, because that's what this is all about. This is to play. And come in with this feeling of, I am so excited to show you my stuff.
Yeah.
And that completely changed your mindset in terms of the whole audition game.
Yeah. I was curious about casting in this way. So one of my favorite shows is Yellowstone. And Rip from Yellowstone, I know Cole Hauser from Dazed and Confused and, you know, Good Will Hunting as this redheaded, skinny, obnoxious kid. And then you see Rip and he's heavier and hot and like everyone's obsessed with him. But that is not who Cole is or was. And so I always was fascinated by that casting choice. So like in a situation like that, did he come up with the character and the way that it looked and show up and say, I want this role, this is who I see it as? Or did some genius casting director say, wait, this is Cole, can do this, and we're going to come up with what it looks like?
Well, I don't watch the show, but I understand the situation that you're explaining.
Okay.
And it is our job as casting directors to know the width and the breadth of what these actors can bring, because we have been in rooms with them for years to decades and seen them do so many different characters, along with seeing them on stage, where they generally will be able to take a character that no one will cast them in a TV show or a film. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen all sides of them. Also, what I like to do is have what's called a general meeting with an actor, where they come in and we just talk. It's not an audition. And so I'll find out things that, you know, oh, they play the banjo. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows that. And or that, you know, they're actually really funny in a dark way, but they never get shown that way. So that's why I like to have these like personal one-on-ones to see that, and also just do a boatload of homework to know what they bring. And so, you know, is that something that Cole brought? Yes. It's also something that the casting director knew that he had in him. Right. And, you know, our job is to sell 25 people on our idea and get them all to approve it.
Right. Right. That must be
hard.
Which
means, you know, all these studio executives, the immediate filmmakers, the, you know, the director, the producers, the writer, and then all these film executives that want to put their fingerprints on it. And so at the end of the day, it could be like 25 to 30 people that we need to get approval from.
And they might have their own mindset on,
of course,
looking different, sounding different, whatever. And you have to convince them.
And for me, the most interesting casting is casting somebody out of left field that you never expected. For instance, on Footloose, I cast two people that the role was not written that way. John Lithgow, who played the father, the preacher, he was written as this Paul Newman-esque, very handsome, salt and pepper hair, charismatic character. And I thought, okay, interesting. I'll bring you guys like that. And then I had seen John Lithgow in The World According to Garp, playing a transsexual, and Brian De Palma's Blowout, where he played a serial killer, you know, two completely different roles. But I thought, how interesting is this guy? This guy is such a chameleon. And so when I brought him up to the director, he said, no way, that's ridiculous. And so it's my job to convince him to like, give him a chance, just have him come in and read. And he came in and read, and he read, and this is again, back in the days before videotape. And so it was just him and myself reading. And he read one scene, and he was so amazing. And he gave him the job in the room.
I'm curious if people, actors, get really weird around you because they know you hold so much power for their career. Does everybody, when they see you, you know, attack
sometimes,
you,
hug you? You know, sometimes, but, you know, I'm just like so open, and they know that I'm on their side. And so that, you know, goes away after a moment or two.
Right. Are there any films that you, in your career, in both careers, casting and as an IC, that you are the most proud of, that you are just so happy you worked on, so proud of the actors, the situation?
E.T. is definitely one at the top of the list. You know, it's really great to work on something that is timeless, you know, that it like you can watch it 30 years later and it still hits. Mm-hmm. Mean Girls, I saw it the other night and it still is just hilarious. And then this little movie I cast that I also co-produced called The Spitfire Grill. And it was my first indie, and it was just a couple million dollars. And it was a beautiful script. And we ended up at Sundance and we won the audience award. And it's really a beautiful film.
Amazing. I have to see that. So this Thursday, something is coming out on Hulu called Rats.
I think it's Friday, actually.
Friday, excuse me. Yeah. And it's a documentary all about the Brat Pack, essentially, and how they feel about how they were stigmatized, so to speak, decades ago. You cast so many of these movies that they refer to in there. What was that like for you? And what's your relationship with those guys now?
I went to the premiere last Friday in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival, where it premiered. And so Andrew McCarthy, I've probably cast him in like four movies. He introduced me to his wife as like, here's the woman that helped us buy our house. So he came to interview me. He just called me and said, you know, I'd love to hear your input on this whole phenomenon. Because he wrote a book about it, which was I really loved, and we've been in touch. And it's really about how 35 years later, you look at this thing that was so important, but you're looking at it through a different lens now. because you have life experience and maturity, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And so his plan was to go around and interview everybody that was involved in the film, along with people like Malcolm Gladwell. Mm-hmm. So to talk about culture, and Bret Easton Ellis. And so my part was, I really kind of feel like the connective tissue between some of these films and these actors. You know, at the time, there was just this amazing pool of talent. Mm-hmm. And I was coming up in the casting world as they were coming up. And so a lot of people will come to me and say, you were my first audition. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, Sean Penn and Nick Cage and, you know, some of these astonishing actors of our time. We were just all starting out together, and I was friends with a lot of these people. So it was an amazing time. And so the interview went very well, I thought, and I ended up in the film, which is great, not on the cutting room floor. And then to see them all again was utterly surreal, you know, to reconnect with Demi and Ali and Andrew, I've seen and talked to, and John Cryer and Howie Deutsch. They were all there. And it was really something. It felt like my life was flashing before me.
Well, it is. It does say something that so many of these films that you've cast in the past are timeless. I mean, it's not just E.T. Your roster is a timeless group of actors that we still, you know, see on camera today. Mm-hmm. And then films that we still watch and pass down to our children that you're like, you have to watch this. This is one of my all-time favorites. So I think that says a lot about you and your talent. So it'll be interesting to see how this new sort of journey in your career additionally pans out for you. And you'll have so many more stories, I'm sure. Where can people find you if they want to learn more, if they want to sign up for one of your classes and find out more about auditioning?
Well, I have two websites. One is just my name, marcyleroff.com. And then I have an IC website that's just specific to that. And it's marcyleroffic.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Marcy. I wish you the best.
Thank you, Rachel. This was really great. Lovely to talk to you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.